Lecture 7 of The Foundations of Human Experience by Rudolf Steiner. Synopsis. The human being from a spiritual standpoint. Observations of consciousness levels. Concerning comprehension. The loss of the capacity of the body to absorb the spiritual with increasing age. From the child's feeling will to the elderly person's feeling thinking. Observation of what is purely soul in adults. Freedom. The task of education is to separate feeling from willing. The nature of sensation. The misleading view of modern psychology and Moritz Benedict's correct observations. The sleepy, dreamy nature of the body's surface as the realm of sensing. The willing, feeling nature of sense perception. The difference of sensations in children and elderly people. Waking, dreaming, and sleeping in human spatiality. A sleeping, dreaming surface and inner core and the wakeful nervous system lying between. The nerves in relationship to the spirit soul. The formation of voids for the nerves through continual dying. Sleeping and waking in connection with human temporality. Forgetting and remembering. End of synopsis. Lecture 7, given in Stuttgart, August 28, 1919. It is important for you to have insight into what the essence of the human being actually is. In our survey of general pedagogy, we have attempted to understand the human being first from the point of view of the soul and then from the standpoint of the spirit. Today we want to continue the latter. Of course, we will have to continually refer to pedagogical concepts and to commonplace modern ideas about the soul and psychology, since you will later want to study pedagogical and psychological literature. When you look at the human being from the perspective of the soul, our emphasis is on discovering the role of antipathies and sympathies. However, when we look at the human being from the spiritual standpoint, we must focus upon discovering states of consciousness. Yesterday, we discussed the three states of consciousness active within the human being, waking, dreaming, and sleeping. And we showed that waking is really present only in thinking cognition, while dreaming prevails in feeling, and sleep in willing. All comprehension is only the act of relating one thing to another. In the world, we cannot comprehend other than by relating one thing to another. That is the method. When we cognitively relate ourselves to the world, we first observe. Either we observe with our senses, as we normally do, or we develop ourselves further and observe with the soul and the spirit, as we do with imagination, inspiration, and intuition. However, spiritual observation is still only observation, and we must complete it through comprehension. We can understand only when we relate one thing to another in our surroundings and in the cosmos. You can create good concepts of body, soul, and spirit when you take into account the complete human lifespan. However, you must remember that in relationships like those I will mention in a moment, we have only the very first steps of comprehension. You must further develop these concepts. If you observe a newborn child and look at its form, its movements, how it expresses itself in crying and babbling and so forth, you will get a picture of the human body. However, you will have a complete picture of the human body only when you relate it to human middle age and old age. In middle age, the human is more connected with the soul, and in old age, more with the spirit. It would be easily possible to contradict this last observation. Many people might, of course, say that in old age people again become feeble-minded. This objection is raised particularly by materialism about the soul-spirit, namely that in old age people become mentally weak. Materialists contend that even such a great person as Kant became feeble-minded in old age, That is true. The objection raised by materialists is true, but it does not prove what they want it to prove. Kant, as he stood before the gates of death, was wiser than he was in his childhood, but in his childhood his body was capable of absorbing all his wisdom. In this way, his wisdom could become conscious in the physical body. However, in old age, his body was incapable of absorbing what the Spirit gave him. His body was no longer a good tool of the Spirit. Thus, in the physical plane, Kant was no longer able to become conscious of what lived in his spirit. In spite of the apparent validity of the objection just described, we must, nevertheless, be clear that in old age, people become wise and astute, and that they approach the spiritual world. Thus, we will need to recognize the beginnings of spiritual characteristics in older people who have maintained an elasticity and life force for their spirit. There are such possibilities. In Berlin, there were once two professors. The one, Michelet, was a Hegelian and was over 90. Since he was rather astute, he was given an emeritus professorship. However, even though he was old, he still held his lectures. Then there was another professor, Zeller, a historian of Greek philosophy. In comparison to Michelet, Zeller was a youngster, since he was only 70. Yet you could hear everywhere that he felt the burden of age and that he could no longer hold his lectures. To this, Michelet always said, quote, "I do not understand Zeller. I could give lectures all day long, but Zeller in his youthfulness continually says that that would be too difficult for him," unquote. We may find only a few instances where the spirit is visible in the physical existence of old age. Nevertheless, it is possible. In contrast, if we look at how human beings express themselves in middle age, we can find the basis for observing the soul. People in middle age can more easily deny the soul. They can appear either without a soul or extremely inspired, since the soul exists in human freedom, which includes education. That many middle-aged people appear to have no soul proves nothing in regard to the fact that middle age is actually the age of the soul. If you compare the child's wiggly, unconscious physical nature with the contemplative, quiet nature of older people, you have, on the one side, the child's body that particularly emphasizes itself, and on the other, the body of an older person that allows itself to recede, that in a certain sense denies itself as a body. If we apply this view more to the soul, then we would say that people carry within themselves thinking cognition, feeling, and willing. If we look at a child, we see in the picture of the child's soul a close connection between willing and feeling. We could say that in the child, willing and feeling are grown together. When children kick or wiggle, they make exactly those movements that reflect their feelings at that moment. The child is unable to separate movement from feeling. With elderly people, it is different. There, the situation is just the opposite. Namely, thinking cognition and feeling are grown together, and the will presents itself independently. The course that human life follows is such that feeling, which is at first connected to willing, slowly separates itself from willing during the passage of life. In education, we are quite often concerned with the question of separating feeling from willing. When freed from willing, feeling then connects itself with thinking cognition and is concerned with it in later life. We properly prepare children for later life only when we enable them to successfully separate feeling from willing. Later, as men or women, they can connect their free feeling with thinking cognition, and thus fully meet life. Why do we listen to older people when they tell us about their life experiences? Because during their lives, they have connected their personal feeling with their concepts and ideas. They do not tell us about theories, they tell us about the feelings they have joined to ideas and concepts. From elderly people who have really connected their feeling with thinking cognition, concepts and ideas sound warm. They sound saturated with reality. They are concrete, personal. With people who have not progressed as adults, concepts and ideas sound theoretical, abstract and sterile. It is a part of human life that the capacities of the human soul develop along a certain path. The feeling will of the child develops into the feeling thinking of an older person, and between these two lies human life. We can properly prepare children for this human life only if we can examine education psychologically. In observing the world, we must consider something that occurs first and that all psychological theories describe as occurring first, namely, sensation. We have sensation when any of our senses encounters our surroundings. We sense colors, tones, heat, and cold. This is the way our senses communicate with our surroundings. You cannot get an accurate picture of what sensation really is from the way sensing is normally described in psychology. When psychologists speak of sensation, they say that a physical process occurs, such as the vibrations of light or waves in the air that stream to our sense organs and stimulate them. Psychologists talk about stimulation, elevate it to a specialized term, but have no desire to fully understand it. Through the sense organ, stimulation creates a feeling in our soul, a qualitative feeling arising from a physical process, for example, hearing, which results from the vibrations of waves in the air. This is what psychologists usually say. Modern scientific psychology is totally unable to give any information about how this actually occurs. You will come closer to an understanding of such things when, instead of looking to psychological considerations, you use your insight into the nature of sensation to answer the question as to which soul force is most closely connected with sensation. Psychologists simplify such things by simply making sensing part of cognition. Let me read that again. Psychologists simplify such things by simply making sensing part of cognition. They say that first we sense, then we perceive, then we make ourselves a picture, form concepts, and so forth. At first this appears to be the process, but they pay no attention to the actual nature of sensation. If through sufficient self-observation we really see what sensing is, we will recognize that sensing has the nature of will with a tendency toward feeling. At first it is not connected with thinking cognition, but with feeling will. I do not know how many psychological theories have recognized anything of the relationship of sensing to feeling will. Parenthesis, of course, we cannot know all the countless modern scientific theories. Parenthesis. To say that sensing is related to will would not be quite correct, because it is related to feeling will. That it is related to feeling was recognized by at least one psychologist who has particularly well-developed powers of observation, namely Moritz Benedict in Vienna. Of course, psychologists hardly notice this psychological theory. There is something unusual about it. First, Moritz Benedict is by training a criminal anthropologist, but he writes about psychological theories. Second, he is a natural scientist, but he writes about the importance of poetry in education, and even analyzes such works to show how we can use them. This is something horrible. The man claims to be a scientist, but believes psychologists can learn something from poets. Finally, a third thing. This man is a Jewish natural scientist who has written a psychological text and dedicated it to no less than a Catholic priest, then on the theological faculty of the University of Vienna, Lawrence Müllner. These three terrible things make it impossible for real psychologists to take this person seriously. Nevertheless, they would take him seriously if they read his psychological text. They would find so many really striking perceptions in it that they would gain much, even though they would have to reject the conclusions of his psychological theory, anchored as they are in Benedict's materialistic way of thinking. Psychologists would not gain anything from the totality of Benedict's book, but would gain much from his specific observations. This is a case where we must seek the best in the world where it occurs. If someone is a good observer in specific instances, but has a repulsive general tendency, as is the case with Benedict, then we need not reject that person's good specific observations. Sensations, as they occur in human beings, are feeling will. We must therefore say that where human senses are externally active, we carry the senses on the surface of our body, if I may express this coarsely. Feeling, will, exists in a certain sense. If we draw a sketch of the human being, we could say that on the surface, remember this is all only schematic, we have the sphere of the senses, and it is there that feeling, will, exists. What is it that we do on this surface, where feeling, will, exists insofar as the surface of the body is the area of sensing? We practice an activity that is half sleep and half dream. We could call it a dreamy sleep or a sleepy dream. We sleep not only at night, but continuously at our periphery, on the outer surface of our bodies. And as people, we are unable to completely comprehend our sensations, because in the area where these sensations occur, we only sleepily dream. Psychologists have no idea that what keeps us from comprehending sensations is identical to what hinders us from bringing our dreams into clear consciousness when we wake up in the morning. The concepts of sleep and dream have another meaning, much different from those we normally use. In normal life, we only know that when we go to bed at night, we sleep. We do not realize that sleep is something much more widespread that occurs continuously on the surface of our body. Dreams continuously mix with sleep on our bodily surface. These quote-unquote dreams are sensations before the intellect and thinking cognition comprehends them. You must also seek children's will and feeling in their senses. For this reason, we emphasize so strongly that we must continuously act upon the children's will when we educate them intellectually. Into everything children see, into everything they perceive, we must also incorporate will and feeling. Otherwise, we will deny the children's sensations. We can only speak to elderly people, to those in the twilight of life, when we understand that their sensations are already metamorphosed. In elderly people, sensations have already moved from feeling will to feeling thinking. In such people, sensations are something different and are more like thought and less like the restlessness of will. That is, they have greater quietude. Only in elderly people are sensations more like concepts and ideas. Usually psychologists do not make these fine distinctions about sensations. For them, the sensations of elderly people are the same as those of children, because sensation is simply sensation. This is the same kind of logic as saying a butter knife is a type of knife, and therefore we could use it to carve meat, because a knife is a knife. In such cases, people form the concept from the word. However, we should never do that. Instead, we should form the concept from the facts. We find that sensations live, and that they go through a certain process during life, that they are more like will in children and more like the intellect in elderly people. Of course, it is easier for people simply to derive concepts from words, which is why we have so many people who explain the meaning of words. But that can have a very negative effect upon us. I once met with a former schoolmate. We had both attended the same elementary school, and then I went to high school, and he went to a teacher training school, which, in addition, was Hungarian. In those days, in the 1870s, that really meant something. After several years, we met again and talked about light. I had learned what was taught in regular physics, namely that light had something to do with waves and ether and so forth. This was at least something that could be seen as the basis of light. My former schoolmate said that he had also learned about light, namely that light is the reason we see. This was simply playing with words. In this way, concepts become simple explanations of words. You can imagine what kind of education the children who were taught by this man received. We must pry ourselves away from words and come to the spirit of things. When we want to understand something, we must not always think immediately about the word, but instead seek out the real relationships. If we look up the origins of the word spirit in Mauthner's etymology and ask how the word first arises, we will find that it is connected with, quote, foam or froth, spray, unquote, and with, quote-unquote, gas. This relationship exists, but it would not lead to anything useful. Unfortunately, this method often appears in a concealed form in Bible research, and thus the Bible is the book most people, particularly modern theologians, least understand. Our goal must be to proceed everywhere in an objective manner. For instance, we do not attempt to form a concept of spirit through etymological research, but rather compare the child's physical activity with that of an older person. By relating facts with one another, we can arrive at true concepts. We can have a real concept of sensation only when we know that it originates as feeling will in the child's physical periphery, because in comparison with the child's inner being, the physical periphery sleeps and dreams. You are fully awake in thinking cognition, but you are also fully awake only inside your body. On the periphery, on the surface of the body, you continue to sleep. Furthermore, what occurs in the surroundings of the body, or better said, on the surface of the body, occurs in a similar way in the head, and occurs most strongly the deeper we go into the human being, in muscles and blood. There again the human being sleeps and dreams. People sleep and dream on the surface, and again more inwardly they also sleep and dream. Our feeling, that is more soul will, our feeling will, our life of desire, remains more within us, and thus is also in a dreaming sleep. Where, then, are we completely awake? In the area between, during our waking hours. Our spatial application of wakefulness and sleep to the human being is from a spiritual standpoint connected with the human form. From the spiritual perspective, we can see the human being as sleeping on the surface, and deep within, and during life between birth and death, able to be fully awake only in the space between. Which organs are most fully developed in this middle region? They are those organs, particularly in the head, that we call the nerves, namely the nervous system. The nervous system sends its runners both to the furthest extent of the surface and also deep inside. The nerves go to all these areas, and in addition to areas of the middle zone, such as the brain, particularly the spinal cord, and also the vagus nerve in front. Let me read that again. The nerves go to all these areas, and in addition to areas of the middle zone, such as the brain, particularly the spinal cord, and also the vagus nerve in front. There, we have the opportunity to be completely awake. Where the nerves are most completely developed is also where we can be most awake. However, the nervous system has an unusual relationship to the spirit. It is an organ that, due to the functions of the body, always tends to decay and become mineralized. If in a living human you could separate the nervous system from the remaining elements of gland, muscle, blood, and from the bone element, parenthesis, you could, though, leave the bone system together with the nervous system, parenthesis, you would already have a corpse in a living human being. Dying occurs continuously in the human nervous system. The nervous system is the only system that has no direct connection to the spirit soul. Blood, muscles, and so forth always have some direct connection to the spirit soul. However, the nervous system never has a direct connection. That it has any connection to the spirit soul is only because it continuously shuts itself off from human functioning. It is not present because it continuously decays. The other elements live and therefore form direct connections to the spirit soul. The nervous system is in a continuous state of dying. It is always saying to the human being, quote, you can develop, because I present you with no hindrance, because I make sure that I am not there with my life, unquote. That is what is so peculiar. In psychology and physiology, you will find the nervous system presented as the organ from which we receive sensations, thinking, and the spirit soul in general. However, how is it that this organ is the intermediary? It is possible only because the nervous system removes itself from life, and thereby presents no hindrance to thinking and sensing. It, in fact, has absolutely no connection to thinking and feeling, and, where it exists, it allows the human being to be empty in relationship to the spirit soul. Where the nerves exist, the spirit soul meets only spaces, gaps, and where these gaps exist, the spirit soul can enter. We must be thankful to the nervous system that it is not concerned with the spirit soul, and that it, in fact, does not do any of the things physiologists and psychologists say it does. If, for only 5 minutes, the nerves did what physiologists and psychologists say nerves do, in those 5 minutes we would be unable to know anything of the world. We would sleep. The nerves do the same thing that all other organs do that mediate sleep, that mediate the feeling will. It is difficult for us when we confront what physiology and psychology say is the truth, because people say we turn the world upside down. The truth is that it is already standing on its head, and that we need to set it on its legs through spiritual science. Physiologists say that nerves, particularly the brain, are the organs of thinking. The truth is that the brain and nervous system are connected with thinking cognition only because they always shut themselves off from human functioning, thereby allowing thinking cognition to unfold. Let us now focus quite exactly upon something. In the sense sphere surrounding the human being, real processes occur which are always entering world events. For example, light acts upon the human being through the EYE, eye. In the eye, that is, in the sense sphere, real processes occur, namely a physical-chemical process. It continues into the depths of the human body, and eventually comes to that inner region, where such physical-chemical processes again occur. Now imagine that you are standing in front of a lit surface, and that light rays from this lit surface fall upon your eyes. There, physical-chemical processes occur and continue on into the muscle and blood within you. In between is an empty zone. In this vacant zone, which exists due to the emptiness of the nerves, such processes as occur in the eye or deeper within you do not develop. What exists in this middle zone is a continuation of what exists outside, namely the nature of light, the nature of colors themselves, and so forth. Therefore, on the surface of our body, where the senses are, we have real processes that are dependent on the eye, the ear, organs for sensing heat, and so forth. Similar processes also exist deep within us. However, in between, where the nerves spread out and make free space, we can live with what exists outside. The eye changes light and color. However, where you have nerves, you are, regarding life, empty. Here, light and color do not change, and thus you live with light and color. You are separated from the outer world only concerning the sense sphere, but within, you live with these outer processes as though from inside a shell. There, you yourself become light. There, you yourself become tone. There, the processes spread out, because the nerves present none of the hindrances of blood and muscle. Now we can have a feeling for the importance of this. In the empty space present within us, we are awake in relation to life, while on our outermost surface and at our innermost core, we sleepily dream and dreamily sleep. We are completely awake only in a region lying between our outermost periphery and innermost depths. All this is said in relationship to spatiality. When we observe the human being from the viewpoint of the spirit, we must also connect the temporal with waking, sleeping, and dreaming. You learn something. You learn it such that it enters your consciousness. During the time you are concerned with it, and when you think about it, it is in your consciousness. Then your life goes on to something else. Something else gains your interest and takes your attention. What happens now to what you learned before, to the object of your previous concern? It begins to go to sleep, and when you again recall it, it awakens. Let me read that again. It begins to go to sleep, and when you again recall it, it awakens. You can understand these things only when you replace all that playing with psychological words, such as remembering and forgetting, with real concepts. What is remembering? It is the awakening of an integrated group of pictures. And what is forgetting? That is the going to sleep of an integrated group of pictures. In this way, you can compare reality with things really experienced and not simply have word definitions. If you think about waking and sleeping, if you experience yourself going to sleep or see others going to sleep, you have there a real process. You can relate forgetting, an inner activity of the soul, to a real process, not to some word. And you can say that forgetting is only another kind of sleeping, and remembering only an awakening. You can come to a spiritual comprehension of the world only when you compare things that are real. To connect the body and spirit, at least in a rudimentary manner, by comparing the stage of life during childhood with that of old age, you must compare remembering and forgetting by relating them to something real, to going to sleep and awakening. What will be so very necessary for the future of humanity is that people accustom themselves to delving into reality. Today, people think almost only in words. They do not think in terms of reality. How could people today gain a sense for what is real and for what we can have when we speak of remembering and awakening? In the broad spectrum of connotations of these words, people will hear everything possible in order to define memory, but they will not think to look at reality, at the facts themselves, in order to understand memory. It is therefore understandable that when we speak to people about something like the threefold social organism, which derives completely out of reality and not out of abstract concepts, they at first do not understand this because they are unaccustomed to deriving things from reality. They do not associate any concepts with things derived out of reality. In their theories, socialist leaders, for example, have not the least idea of deriving things out of reality. They represent the final stage, the final level of decadence, with their explanation of words. These people believe they understand something of reality better than anyone else. However, when they begin to speak, they can use only the most meaningless words. The above is only a parenthetical remark, but it is connected with our modern stream of thinking. However, educators must understand the times in which they live, because they must also understand the children of those times. The end of Lecture 7.